Of course, we're here this evening to hear from Robin Oak. You'll likely know the famous story of him coming out the next day after his son was murdered and publicly forgiving the murderer. Now, obviously, we're really grateful for Robin to coming. Robin, would you like to come and join me? And I'm just going to ask you a few questions just by way of introduction. Robin, where have you come from today?
I've come from Shrewsbury.
And would you call that home?
No, not really.
Okay, where's home?
Bicton, there's a village just outside Shrewsbury.
Okay, brilliant. And have you left family behind today?
I've left my wife at home, yes.
Okay, right. And tell me, as a sports person myself, tell me what you're doing tomorrow morning.
At 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, I'm teeing off in a golf match with the ladies versus the men.
Brilliant. Yeah. That is brilliant. That's brilliant. And are you hoping the men will win this time?
The men are going to win this time.
Excellent.
Come on.
Good. Good. That's what I like to hear. Now, a policeman for a long time. Did you have a particular specialism?
Yes, I did. From the rank of inspector upwards, I was in counter-terrorism.
Right, okay. Very interesting. I'm sure you'll say more about that later. Did you always aspire to be a policeman?
No, I didn't. I wanted to go in the Navy, if anything, but somehow or other I got warded away from that. National service came along and I was medically unfit for that. So I was stuck without a job. I'd left school. What do I do? Medically unfit for the army. Grade 4, never fit enough to even fight. So my parents paid for a private medical at Harley Street. It must have cost them the earth. And they said, there's nothing wrong with you, except you've got big feet. As a result of that, I joined the police force.
What size are your feet?
14.
14. On that note, I'm going to hand over to you and leave it with you.
Well, thank you so much. And it's jolly nice to meet you all. And I think this is the first time in my life I've ever spoken after I should have finished. Because it's 20 past 7 according to that. And it's not actually correct, is it? Oh, no, you're behind the times. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm not going to talk about forgiveness right the way through because I feel you need a bit of background. And thus I'm going to talk a little bit about the police service, but mostly, ultimately, about the things that I was told the day I joined the police force. I was 19, and when I turned up at the police college, the chief superintendent welcomed the other 19 and myself. None of us knew each other, so we were all a bit nervous, I guess. And he spoke for 20 minutes, which was 19 minutes too long, as far as I was concerned, because we'd already been handed some uniform, all of which need pressing, and an instruction book, and having been told we've got to learn the first page, whatever happens before tomorrow morning's parade. But the very last thing that chief superintendent said as he walked out of the room, oh, by the way, three things for you, and don't forget them. You will meet the unexpected. You'll never get rich, and keep your sense of humour. And he's absolutely right in everything on that. And it's the unexpected, which I probably will major on, the things I want to talk about tonight, the things which you don't actually think might happen. When you go out on the beat as a police officer, you have no idea for the next 8 hours what you're going to do, who you're going to meet, what you're going to do when someone commits an offence, and so on and so forth. It isn't all arresting by any means. A lot of it is people collapsing in the street and getting ambulances and just chatting to people. I used to love, when I had a tall helmet, walking along the high street of St. John's Wood. And if my hat hit the canopy as it came down, I knew that they committed an offence because they have to be 8 feet above the ground. Not that I ever reported them, but I did walk in there holding my head and say, come on, put it up just a little bit, just a bit of fun for being a police officer. I have found so much humour, even in the midst of tragedy. And so that's what really tonight is all about. My parents were not Christian folk, although later on they were converted. But in my young days, certainly they weren't. But they used to send my sisters, two of sisters, both older than me, my mother often said, Robin is the mistake of the family. What a thing to be told. But there we are, I was the unexpected baby. But my two elder sisters were absolutely super girls, both of whom became Christians. And it was the oldest of the two sisters, she was a gym mistress. And while she was at college, she came home and told us all in the summer vacation that she'd become a Christian. And my mother said, as we were eating our beans on toast, well, surely we're all Christians, aren't we? And Cherry, bless her heart, began to explain that she wasn't a Christian, although we went to church. And it wasn't until she received Christ into her life that made all the difference. And of course, a lot of that was a help to me, because I wasn't a Christian, but I saw the difference that it made. I've mentioned training school and the unexpected. First night in training school, as I said already, you don't know the other 19. And so I was a bit shy. I was a new Christian. But I had got into the habit with my sister of kneeling down and praying before going to sleep. And I did exactly that. But the dormitory where we were housed 25 people on one side and 25 the other. And we were only separated into cubicles by bits of plywood, which I could see over the top. And it was only about that high from the ground, so they could swill it through, I suppose, to clean it. And as I knelt down, in a moment, the door flung open. And my next-door colleague said to me, what the hell do you think you're doing? Because my feet were in his cubicle while I was praying. So he was the one who told the rest of the crowd, oh, dear, we got Robin Oak, he's a bit religious. I didn't mind that, really. I have to say, in the police force, I got a fair bit of chiaiking, being a Christian, but it was never cruel, it was never harsh, and to me it was always a great opportunity, and I'm thanking God that they actually knew me. When I got out to St. John's Wood, which is by Lord's Cricket Ground, it's a good place to be as a constable, plenty of work and plenty of cricket when you're off duty. We were allowed to go in on our warrant card so long as we told the stewards where we were in case it was a riot. Well, there was no rioting in cricket in those days. So we would sleep off our night duty watching cricket. Wonderful. But in my first 2 weeks, I was out with an older PC, and his name was Broomhead, but known as Brush to everybody. And he said at 1:30, as he looked at his watch, Robin, it would be nice to have a little damage-only accident between two cars. It'll take perhaps 1/4 hour to write up, and then we can go off duty at 2. And as he said that, there was a great hullabaloo behind me of people yelling out, stop thief, hey, come back. And I just caught the tail end of a crowd chasing somebody down St. John's Wood High Street. Brush said to me, Robin, you're fit, you've come out of training school, get after him. He can't get out at the bottom end. He's bound to come back here and I will arrest him. Well, I got hold of this guy long before we got back to Brush. I was out of breath. I couldn't remember what to say, what I'd been taught at training school, and you have to caution these people. There we were panting away. He was panting and frightened. I was panting, but not frightened so much, although wondering what the sergeant was going to say. Because I walked this guy into the police station at 1:50, and the sergeant said, oh, no, I wanted to go off at 2. Now look what you've done. So when I said to this fellow, when we charged him with theft, he had a bundle of £40, which he'd nicked from the underground station. I said to him, why? He said, well, I'm an athlete, and I can't do my athletics because I've hurt my foot. The only way I can keep on my athletics is by taking painkillers, and I can't afford the drugs anymore. I have no money. I'm unemployed. And so I'm desperate, and that's why I stole it. He said, I was in the Olympic Games in 1956. Well, here we are in 1957, and I've actually arrested an Olympic athlete. Just think of that. So I said to him, what was your event? Oh, he said, I was a walker. So I was quite deflated, I have to admit that. As I walked down Abbey Road, which is the very place where the Beatles did their big recordings in the recording studios there, it was probably 2 a.m. There was an awful crash behind me, and I turned round to see a lorry which had gone up a pavement and into a garden wall, and a car half crunched underneath between the front and the back wheels of this lorry, and it was already on fire. And so I ran back and got underneath the lorry. Fortunately, the driver's door had burst open, but there was a man in there, American soldier actually, who was unconscious. And he was actually on fire up his side. So I got him out and pulled him out into the road and rolled him over, and we got the flames out. But to me, that was a terrible shock, because I'd never seen anybody burning. First aid, oh yes, you have to join St. John Ambulance the day you join the police force, and I'm still in St. John Ambulance. I was so grateful for that, of one, dealing with burns, and two, dealing with somebody who's just about to lose his life. Wonderfully, the ambulance came in good time to bring this fellow almost round, but certainly in hospital, bring him round, and he was eventually flown back to America. But it was a night where I thought, how nice, nothing's happening, I can walk around my beat, I might even catch a burglar. But I spent the whole night just with this one guy who'd gone across the crossroads against a halt sign and very nearly killed himself. I was in Maida Vale some while after that, and a bus stopped right beside me, and the bus conductor, in the days when he had a pole at the back, do you remember those buses? And the driver was separate, but the conductor got hold of a lady there and said, there you are, there's a policeman. That was me. And I said, what's the problem? She said, I'm just about to deliver a baby. My waters have gone on the bus. I had up my sleeve a Daily Telegraph, and I was hoping to get off duty to go and play rugby, but I said, come on, you better lie down here on the Daily Telegraph. And she actually gave birth on page 2. Once again, that was new to me. In the St. John Ambrose book, you're not taught how to deliver a baby. But wonderfully, the baby came. I thought she might have called the baby after me. But oh no, it was a girl, and she called it something else completely different. But unexpected, absolutely. As a PC, I was taken into Scotland Yard after 3.5 years. I still wonder how it was that my name got selected to go and work up there. And that was the beginning. And I've told you later on I got into counter-terrorism, but that was the beginning of it in Scotland Yard, where my boss said to me, Robin, welcome, it's good to have you. I think I ought to tell you this. We insist that you take the promotion exam within a year of you coming here, and which is exactly what happened. And 2 years later, I found myself as a sergeant, and a sergeant in what's known as C Division in Soho in London. Wonderfully busy place, and I loved it down there. The early days of Soho were such that I hardly knew anybody in the station. And when I tell you we used to parade 80 PCs 3 times a day, that's a lot of policemen. One of the places we went to was a strip club, which we raided. And when I got down there, the fellow who's the manager of the club was also the manager of the Scotland Yard restaurant. I couldn't believe my eyes. It's the sort of thing he did in his off-duty hours. He was more taken aback, perhaps, than I was. I'd also had a call there about a new strip club and an inspector called Ingram who, if I say this quietly, because you might be in the room, Mr. Ingram, I think you were afraid of the dark. He would not walk through Soho by himself. And my fellow sergeant said to me, as soon as I got there, watch Ingram, he'll take you out and you'll have him the whole night long. So I used to dodge out pretty quickly, but one day he got hold of me because we'd heard about this new strip club in St. Anne's Court. Well, we walked around Soho and I showed him places which he didn't know existed, but we couldn't find the back entrance. You need to know where the back entrance is. If you're going to raid it, people are going to run out of the back entrance. But eventually we passed a scut, as we called it, probably that wide, and we could only get down it like this. And Ingram was in front of me, so down there, he said, there it is, up there. And there was the fire escape and curtains blowing in the wind because the windows were open, the doors were open. And he ran up these stairs 2 at a time, straight through the curtains, and I heard a tremendous cheer because Ingram was on the stage with 2 completely nude women. And all I could hear from the audience was, get him off, thinking he was part of the show. Well, I was stitching with laughter outside, and Mr. Ingram never spoke to me again. That's one of the joys of being a policeman. Quite unexpected, as you can imagine. And again in Soho, I loved the place because it was busy, and I got a lot of good friends there as well, and lots of good informants. But one particular night that I walked around, 199, I always remember that number, a PC was crying out for help. He was in a fight, and he told me he was at the junction of Wardour Street and Soho Street, so I raced round there, but 199 was nowhere to be seen. You wait, I found him later on, I can tell you. But I was now involved in a fight. Both sides who were fighting each other now were fighting me. And I've still got the injuries up here on my face, which you'll see. And I ended up being punched, landing on the ground, and backwards going down some stairs, and with my head opening the door at the bottom of the stairs into a Chinese gambling den, which we've been looking for months. We didn't know it was there. And to see Chinamen's faces watching a policeman coming down upside down, what a raid. But that was Soho for me, and I must admit, fantastic years while I was there. To be promoted inspector, because you've got to take these promotion exams, 6 months at the police college at Bram's Hill in Hampshire, lovely, lovely place, and I eventually went back there on the directing staff. When I came back from there, I was as surprised as anybody. I was in Scotland Yard again, and I got a message to say that I'd been selected from that course with one other man to go to university for 3 years. What a wonderful opportunity. And so I read law at University College London, let my hair down a little bit, but it did mean I saw a lot more of my wife and the children, because we had 3 children, perhaps than I would have done otherwise. But when I came out of there, policing had changed in those 3 years, and it was the beginning of the IRA campaign in London. Some of you will remember that Airey Neave, the MP, was killed, you remember? He had a gravity bomb underneath his car, and as he drove up the from the underground car park, it exploded and killed him. And that was the first of so many bombs and false bombs, all of which had to be looked at. 56 live devices, and the rest, about 200, which you had to think were live. And I brought one along here tonight. You may want to move, I don't know. What am I doing to this book, can you see? I'm opening it from the back. You'd make a good policewoman. We learnt this very, very quickly. If you open it from the front, it's going to explode because this is actually a bomb. I have actually taken out the explosive, so it's not going to go off tonight. You'll notice that these IRA bombs all had the same colour wire, so there was a bit of guesswork involved. And I must admit, it was a frightening time because I was trying to judge, now as a middle-ranking officer, who were the best bosses. And I found those who sat in their office all day and pushed paper and signed this, that and the other and went out to meetings were not the best bosses because they didn't really know what was going on. The best bosses are people who get involved and go out with the lads and the lasses and do the work that they're doing and give them some leadership. And I thought, this is a real big test, Robin. I could have sent PCs, I suppose, to get these bombs diffused, but I thought I'd better do it as well. And one of these occasions, I was there. We'd already drafted in 4 men from the army, bomb disposal officers, one of whom was killed in Oxford Street, defusing one of these bombs. But when I saw Ian, I knew exactly what he was going to say. Robin, how heavy do you think that is? And it wouldn't necessarily be a bomb in a book. It might be a bomb in a package. So then he'll hand you the bomb. How heavy do you think that is? Well, it's about 5 pounds. Well, you know how far it is to clear. Clear the people, and I'll unpack my bags, and when you've done that, come back, and we'll defuse it together. Which meant, it was like being in the operating theatre, I would hand him his tools. And I can tell you, as a Christian man, even as a Christian man, how frightening that was. My heart would pump like mad. Wonderfully, none of them actually exploded in our face. But it was a very trying time, as you can imagine, in the midst of in London there. By being an inspector, the the role, I think, is not just leading the men in policing itself, but getting alongside them. And one day I was in my car, just pootling around, really, north of the Thames, and I heard on the radio of two PCs who were hanging on to a man who tried to jump off Vauxhall Bridge, and they were calling for help. And I wasn't that far away, so I drove up to the bridge, and I saw both my colleagues leaning over, and they were actually holding this fellow's arms. So I helped them to pull him up and pull him over the railings. And I said to them, look, tell you what, can you get an ambulance for me? Go and use my radio in the car, and I'll deal with this fellow. And he was a very, very sad man, a man who had a lot of wealth, but his wife had left him, and his children didn't want to speak to him, and he just decided to end it all by jumping off the bridge. It was an awful moment, really, in one sense, but a wonderful opportunity. I was sitting there waiting for the ambulance, and I asked him, if you die tonight, where are you going to go? He said, I haven't a clue. I said, well, I'm going to help you. I'd like you to go to heaven and not to hell. And he looked at me as if I was daft, and the street lights made his face look absolutely white. But it was a great opportunity to share with him something of the gospel. And although I didn't lead him to Christ on Vauxhall Bridge, I got him into Westminster Hospital and visited him there. And eventually that man in the ward, he had a psychiatric problem as well, I might say, but he did turn to Christ. And it completely changed that man's life, as you can imagine. And it changed his life so much so that his marriage was healed and his children got their dad back. And that's one of the other sides of being a policeman. It's not all crime by any means. It is helping people in their distress. As a chief inspector, that's the next rank up. That's when I started on this counter-terrorism, having had the counter-terrorism with IRA. And I was lecturing there at Bramshill, the National Police College, or the International Police College in Hampshire. And from there was drafted up to Manchester and also Northern Ireland, because that was all part of it. And my tour in Northern Ireland, I must admit, was really hairy, partly because I wasn't a frontline officer and I wasn't a Royal Ulster Constabulary man. But looking at strategy and seeing how we could do it from the overall picture, which meant flying around in a helicopter. And that might sound very exciting to you, and I suppose it was to a point, but my staff officer couldn't take it. He hated flying anyway. And one day he said to me, Mr. Oak, this is it. I'm not doing this anymore. I said, well, how are you going to get back from Londonderry to Belfast to Manchester? Well, he said, I'll find a way. I said, well, the way is with me. So you come on, get into this helicopter and off we'll go. We were up in the air, I guess, about, a minute, when suddenly it veered off and the lieutenant commander who was flying the plane said, I'm sorry about that. That was a pylon. I hadn't noticed it. No wonder my staff officer didn't like flying. Then we get across to Aldergrove Airport, and then we have to stop because there's a plane coming in on one engine. So we're hovering like this in the clouds. The poor fellow was being sick behind me. And we landed in Lurgan to do some work there. And he said, that's it, I'm not flying again. I said, you are. In about 20 minutes when I cleared this mess up, we're off again to Belfast. I wanted to be seen in four places at once for a particular reason, which I won't go into. And I have to say, sadly, when we got to Belfast again, Brian, my staff officer, said, that's it, Mr. Oak, I am never flying again. I said, well, how are you going to get back to Manchester? He said, leave that to me, I'll get there. And he did. He went back by boat, the poor fellow. I don't blame him, honestly. It's not everybody's cup of tea. And it didn't end up ruin his career. But that was me in Northern Ireland. I must admit, as a superintendent in Manchester, it was a bit daunting. I went to Moss Side Police Station where my colleague had been shot at, and the bullet hole was still in the window when we arrived. And because nobody knew me. I'd come up from London. I'd been in Northern Ireland working there. And here I'm new to Moss Side. My clerk, who introduced himself to me and took me to my office, and the bullet hole is still there, which nearly killed Colin Rankin, my predecessor. And I said to Bob, what do you like at carrying desks around? What do you mean? I said, that desk is too near the window for me. We're going to put it over there. And that's what we did. So we did a bit of furniture removal. But Moss Side riots, you may have heard of, were not started by the police, believe it or not. We were the bad ones, I suppose, and we were attacked like mad. But having said that, Moss Side, although it's got a bad name, is actually a super place to work, especially from the social part of life. And while I was there, my friendships with the locals were added to, because Charlie Moore, who started the riots in Moss Side and ran a youth club, eventually arrived at the police station. Now I've been trying to find him, to talk with him, to say, why the riots? Come on, let's get on the same side. One of my sergeants phoned up and said, I've got Charlie Moore down. Says, shall I kick him out? I said, don't you dare, I want to speak to him. Sir, do you think that's wise? Yes, I do, I want to speak to him. So I went downstairs to get him, and he wouldn't look me in the eye. I said, come on, will you come up to my office? When I got up to my office, my clerk was in my room, because the sergeant had phoned him up and said, look, the boss is going to get beaten up. Charlie Moore's with him. Anyway, when I got in there, I said to Bob, my clerk, could we have two teas, Bob, and don't hurry? So I got rid of him, and I said to Charlie, why have you come to see me? Well, he said, and he wouldn't look me in the eye, looking at the floor in front of me, he said, I've come to ask your forgiveness. Forgiveness for what, Charlie? Well, you know my role in the riots, and I know a lot of policemen got injured, and I know you as police officers got castigated for the way you policed, but he said, I want your forgiveness. I said, what's happened to you, Charlie? You're not the Charlie Moore I know. He said, I've recently become a Christian. He said, my secretary at Moss Side Youth Club, and this is a man who had convictions for grievous bodily harm and drug offences, running on behalf of Manchester City Council, a big youth club, seemed incredible to me. But he told me that he'd got a girlfriend who was a Christian, and she used to take him to church. And he said, last month, I was converted, and it's completely changed my outlook and my life, and I wanted you to know, can you forgive me? And I looked at Charlie, I said, come here. And I gave him a great big hug at the very moment my clerk walked in. And he thought we were fighting, so he tried to pull us apart. But Charlie Moore became one of a group that met in my office every Thursday afternoon, praying for Moss Side, because the riots there had ruined the place, and there was a lot of bad feeling, and praying that the whole place would change. And it was Charlie Moore himself who suggested, why don't we have a hub? The Burnt Out Cycle Club, which he and his mates had burnt out, it was a cycle shop, sorry, on three floors. Why don't we use that, if we possibly can, as a centre? And that's what happened. On the top floor, we had 2 one-bedroom flats for people who were temporarily homeless. On the first floor, a clothing store, and on the ground floor, a coffee shop. And the condition which Charlie gave us, now bear in mind, he's the local, they used to call him the local tow rag, but he wasn't, he was a new Christian man. Don't forget, he said, we need a policeman in there to staff it. And so I was quite prepared to do that. And one of my PCs each day would go in. And that was the hub and is still the hub. If you go through Manchester on the right-hand side, as you go in on the main road, you'll still see a thing called the Open Door, which was started 30-odd years ago by Charlie Moore. That was our friendship as well. In Manchester, I eventually got the rank of Assistant Chief Constable, and Jim Anderton, lovely Christian man, was the boss. One particular day, I had got home. It had been a very hard, heavy day, and when I got in, Chris, my wife, had the television on, and it showed riots at the Sikh temple in India. And you may think, what on earth's that got to do with Manchester? But I knew that we had a Sikh temple in Manchester, and I knew that the Sikhs and the Hindus didn't get on together, and the likelihood was that that could spread across the world. And what, you could go to Bradford, where they've got Sikhs and Hindus, you could go to Birmingham, you could go to London. It certainly was there in Manchester. So I said to my wife, for an hour or so, you have to leave me. I'm going to try and get something organized for tomorrow. And I rang right round the 14 divisions because I asked the inspector in charge, I want tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock a Hindu and a Sikh leader so that we can talk this out. And if we get it right in Manchester, it'll stop the riots here and maybe in the Golden Temple in India. And 11 o'clock next morning they came in. And I walked into the room, having said to the chief constable, Jim Antrim, would you like to chair this meeting? Oh, no, Robin, you've organised it. You do it. You get on with it. Thank you, sir, very much. Anyway, as I started to open it, a Sikh in the far corner, excuse me, sir, but it was about where you are, he just stood up and said, Mr. Oak, we know you're a man of prayer. Would you like to pray for the meeting? Now, that's unusual, is it not, in a Sikhs and Hindus meeting? So I did. I prayed. I wished I hadn't closed my eyes, because whilst I was praying, apparently there were all sorts of gesticulations going on across the two rows of Hindus and Sikhs. And it was a hairy meeting for an hour and a half. But at the end of it, I'd said, look, if we get this right in Manchester, then surely it's not going to spread to Solihull, and it's not going to spread to Birmingham, it's not going to spread to Bradford and London, and it may even get back to the Golden Temple in India. I'd like you to come back in 3 days and see if you've got it sorted out between yourselves. And off they went. 3 days later, back in the large meeting room in Greater Manchester Police Headquarters, I walked in and that same Sikh in the far corner stood up and said, Mr. Oak, you opened in prayer last time. We want you to see a miracle. Would you just pray now? Now, I think that's the last time I closed my eyes when I was praying. I don't know why we do close our eyes when we pray, but anyway, that I did on that day, and I shut my eyes and prayed, and I looked up. Instead of them being apart from each other, they were actually in a line down the middle of the hall, cuddling each other. Sikhs and Hindus with their arms around each other. It was terrific, and you're nodding like mad, aren't you? Because you know, it's not heard of. And they had wonderfully found a way of sorting out the solution. Now, we never had Sikhs and Hindu riots in Britain, and the next day at the Golden Temple in northern India, that riot finished. And I believe it was because of those Sikhs and Hindus in Manchester who decided to have peace together, it had that effect. And I am so glad that in policing, it's not all crime. A lot of it is social issues, and a lot of it is certainly in private people's homes. Well, I've nearly finished. Very nearly finished. I was very fortunate to be promoted chief constable, and probably, as somebody said to me, Robin, you've got the best chief constableship in the British Isles. I was asked to be the chief constable of the Isle of Man. You cannot actually get better than that. And as chief constable, it was partly because of my counter-terrorism work, because it meant I wasn't in my office every day. My beat, if you can call it that, were the ports and harbours of Europe. And I used to spend a lot of time in counter-terrorism over in the continent. Also, I was asked if I would become the chairman of the Commonwealth Games Association. And I thought, well, I'd love to do it, but have I got time? I spoke to the police committee about it, and they said, if you can do both jobs, Robin, do it. But always make sure that you give the Isle of Man a good press. So they allowed me to be the chairman of the Commonwealth Games, which meant not only the games, I used to go to the conferences around the world, and also link in the counter-terrorism, which I was actually involved in. So two jobs together, and I had a very good deputy who virtually ran the Isle of Man police, and that what a super time that was. I so enjoyed being over there. But, and this really is the climax of what I want to say tonight, my son, Steve, he joined the police force, which surprised me. Up to then, he had no particular ambition. But at the age of 19, he wanted to join the police force, and we chatted it out together. And it wasn't long before he was in, and I went to the passing out parade. I was actually the inspecting officer that day when Steve was there. It's very difficult, isn't it, when you've got your son, and you, as you've seen people doing inspections, haven't you, and they talk to this person and that one, three or four down. And I stopped at Steve, and of course he's been told not to start smiling or look at whoever's talking to you. You have to stand there like this, and there he was. He wanted to hug me, and I wanted to hug him, but you can't do that on a parade. Steve joined the police force. 2 years on the beat, he was taken up to a driving school, and he got such good marks for his driving, he was straight away a class one driver. Now, in policing, there are six classes of driving. You start at class six normally and try and work your way through. And the better drivers are the traffic patrol who go on the motorways and so on. And Steve straight away was, as a class one driver, was on the motorway. Usually when I say that, people go white because they might well have been stopped by my Steve on the motorway. If you have, I'm sure you've been forgiven and you've paid your fine by now. But now, Steve wasn't there to actually catch speeders. Obviously, he had to deal with accidents and so on, but he was largely in a plainclothes car. But it also had blue lights which flashed through the grille at the front and had a siren, but you wouldn't have noticed that until they were on a chase. His job was to deal with criminals who used the motorways as a sort of conduit between their home and what they're going to do, the crime, and they're back home again. You can actually live in London and commit a murder in Birmingham and be back in bed by 5 a.m. because of the motorways, and though they're misused like that, which is a great shame. But Steve was there on that, and it wasn't long before his reputation as someone who can interrogate was so good that he was transferred from traffic patrol into special branch. Now, I have never heard of that either before or since, because to get into special branch, and they're the elite of the CID, you really have to go in as a temporary CID officer, and if you do well at that, you're made a detective constable and maybe a detective sergeant, dependent on how you're doing. But he missed all that, went from traffic, you can't believe it, can you, into the CID special branch. And that was his role. And it was very interesting because I was in counter-terrorism, and he, of course, now was involved in terrorism front line. The special branch office in Manchester is at the airport. And we used to chat together, but very rarely could we share information because you can't do it on the telephone. Anyway, one particular weekend, I went across to Manchester where my wife was looking after grandchildren. My youngest daughter was desperately ill in hospital, so Chris went and looked after the children. And I phoned Steve while I was at Sue's house. I'd seen her in hospital. And I said to Steve, what sort of a week have you got ahead? Daddy said, it's going to be a bit difficult, but on Tuesday, please pray. I can see it's going to be a horrific day. He couldn't tell me what it was. You can't on the telephone talk about terrorism and what police work you're going to do. So that was it. I said I would, and I went back to the Isle of Man where I lived, and Chris stayed in Manchester in Sue's house. 6:30, 2 days later, on the Tuesday, I had prayed for Steve. I got a message from Leslie, my daughter-in-law, Steve's wife. Dad, Steve's been involved in an accident. She said, I don't know any more detail than that, except that a police car's come to pick me up and take me to the hospital in North Manchester. I'll let you know when I get there what's happened. Now, she said to me in that he had got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go into work. So I thought maybe he's fallen asleep at the wheel. And she, strangely enough, was thinking the same thing, as I found out later. When she phoned me at 9:30, so for 3 hours I had waited from 6:30 to 9:30, wondering where Steve was. She phoned. She was at the hospital, and I could hear she was hesitant. You just get a sense. And she blurted to me, Dad, I'm ever so sorry. Steve's been murdered. It still hurts. Imagine how she felt. I tried to get from her what had happened. And she said, I'm sorry, I can't say any more. So she handed the telephone to the Deputy Chief Constable of Manchester, who was a good friend of mine, because I used to work there. And he told me what had happened. Steve was one of several special branch officers around the country looking for a guy who'd escaped from a raid in London, where six Al-Qaeda terrorists were going to put ricin in London's water. I think you ought to know that it's very difficult to raid some of these terrorist camps, houses, whatever, because they only meet together twice. Once, to organise what they're going to do, and two, to actually do it, plant a bomb or whatever. In London, they were going to put ricin in the water at Wood Green, which is a filtration plant. So London's water would have been contaminated with ricin, which is a deadly poison. The bobbies there in London got it right. They actually got there before they'd planted the ricin. But one escaped, and Steve was one of several special branch officers around the country given a very, very good description of this guy, so that even if he were in a burqa, he would have recognised him. So here we are. Steve's been murdered. And when I got the detail of this, he had been on a raid in the morning at 6:30. He'd got up at 4 o'clock that day. And because of what they found in that raid, they decided to have another one in the evening. And Steve went on that. But he wasn't an arresting officer in the evening, although he was in the morning. So he went on the raid, and it wasn't too bad. There was no injuries there. But as he looked round the flat to see what was stashed there, he found this guy who'd escaped from London with the ricin job. He recognised him sit under a table. What he didn't know is that he had a long kitchen knife up his arm. And as Steve tried to drag him out, Steve, with three of his colleagues, one of whom never went back to duty, had a nervous breakdown after this, all three were badly injured, and Steve, unfortunately, was stabbed through the heart and killed outright. So that's what I heard. And I was alone at home, remember, because Chris, my wife, was looking after grandchildren. And it hurt. I had to tell my wife, obviously. And I thought, here we are, it's 9:30. At 10 o'clock, if she's watching the news at Sue's house, she'll probably hear about this, so I'd better tell her on the phone if I could. So I did what I've always told my colleagues never to do. Don't give bad news by telephone, because you don't know what's going to happen. Collapsing the other end. But I had to do it. So I phoned Chris. I don't know exactly what I said, but it was something like this. Darling, I've got some dreadful news for you. Our Steve's been murdered. Complete silence the other end. Darling, I'm sorry to tell you this. And she wanted to know what had happened, and I didn't know all the detail at all, so I couldn't say much. But then she said to me, typical my wife, she ought to be speaking here. She's a much better speaker than me, so there we are. She said, where's Leslie? That's Steve's wife. I said, well, she's still at the hospital, but she's going to be taken home by a police car. Right, she said, I'll make sure I'm there. And so she got hold of Sue. Remember, Sue's in hospital. So Sue's father-in-law lived not far away. David, my son-in-law, could look after the children. So Chris got a lift with father-in-law and was at home in Poynton when Leslie came home from hospital. You can imagine the trauma that was for Chris, for Leslie, for the three children of Steve. And I wasn't too good myself, as you can imagine. There was no way I could sleep. I tried to put my head down. I told my pastor and my prayer partner, who we used to meet every so often, heard this on the news. It was on at 10 o'clock. They came up to the house and stayed the night with me, but I didn't sleep. Next morning, at 7:30, my deputy phoned me and said, "Sir, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the media have chartered a plane. They want to come to the Isle of Man. They've already taken off, and they want to meet with you." I said, "Well, okay. We'll meet them at the airport, and I'll set up a press conference." Well, they landed, I suppose, just after eight on the Isle of Man, and we set up a press conference in Port Erin Police Station. And for the only time in my life, when I walked into a press conference, everybody stood up. Pressmen don't normally stand up for policemen. But I thought that was very gracious of them. And then they sat down, and of course they wanted to know the detail of what happened. And I had, because I'd not slept, written out a 2-page script of what I knew about it, so at least I had something to chew on. And it was going reasonably well until one guy, right at the back, stood up, I'm sure with no guile at all. He simply said to me, "Mr. Oak, what do you think of the man who killed your son?" Now, I hadn't prepared for that. My mind had thought of all the things that the press might ask, but that wasn't one question. And as he stood there, and I stood here this far apart, I was actually praying for the right words, because I knew in the next few seconds, whatever I said, it's going to get printed. And I believe God gave me the strength to say to this journalist, "I don't know precisely what happened. I don't know much detail about it. But I forgive the man who killed my son, and I pray for him." And suddenly, from what had been a very docile press conference, it erupted. They couldn't believe that a senior police officer could forgive a terrorist. It was some minutes before it quietened down a bit, but of course they all wanted to rush this story back to their papers and to the news. By the time I'd got home, about 1 o'clock, there it was on the news. A chief constable forgiving a terrorist. It wasn't easy, as you can imagine. My wife was over in Manchester looking after grandchildren. She had heard this on the radio, or saw it on the television, one way or the other. But I had to say to myself, did I really mean that? So I started to think it through, and I believe, quite honestly, that it was the right thing to say. The thing that went through my mind was the middle line of the Lord's Prayer, which I must have said hundreds of times, "Forgive us our sin as we forgive those who sin against us." And I began to realize that God's forgiveness of us is quite relative to how we forgive other people. Me forgiving a terrorist? Well, I did forgive him. Wonderfully, my wife, when she heard this was up, because it was on the radio and it was on the television, and my daughter-in-law, Leslie, thanked me for doing that and said, "Must have been so hard, but we're with you. And we forgive him too." At the trial, which was some months later at the Old Bailey, we saw the guy there. Now, I've not, because I prayed for him, and because I forgive the man, I still feel justice has got to be done. And we were praying for him while he was in the dock, and we were sitting there in the public gallery. And he was given life imprisonment when he was found guilty. We felt we'd done the right thing. And it's been such a means of grace to other people when we've been able to talk to them about forgiveness. And nothing as serious as a murder, but when we've talked about it. And you ought to know, as I finish, that I speak here not just as a senior police officer retired, but as a man who was converted before I joined the police force. I was a young Christian in my early days as a policeman. And I found that quite difficult, because a lot of policemen aren't Christians, and they don't like to tolerate what they call soft people. I remember talking to a lady about the Christian faith while I was on the beat, And she said, young man, you don't have to worry about me. My nephew is the Bishop of Norwich. I thought, that's a great help. Thank you very much. I used to see that lady quite a lot and ask her how her nephew was, but it didn't seem to affect her life at all. But as a man, I've been forgiven by God so many times. I've been forgiven by my wife and I guess by my children and probably others in the police service. But I thank God that our Christian faith as a family got us through. Steve was a lovely Christian man. He was converted when he was age 17. He was watching a fact and faith film. And the fact and faith film depicted the day when Christ is coming back again and taking with him all those who love him. And Steve realized, hey, mum and dad will be going and I won't. I'm stuck at home. And somehow that film helped him to turn to Christ, and he was a lovely, lovely Christian. Well, for us all here, one day, of course, we're going to die. That's the one big certainty in life, that we all die. But we have to know now, surely, where we're going to go when we do die. And I've been with people who've died, and some people are so frightened, and some are so peaceful. Those who really love the Lord Jesus, it makes such a difference. If you can just pray with them, almost at the moment when they're dying, they smile on their face as they go to meet the Saviour. It's despicable to think that so many discard the gospel, discard the fact that the Lord Jesus died in our place and on the cross was able to say to the people who killed him, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I thank God that I became a Christian before I was a policeman and went through a bit of turmoil as a Christian police officer, because not all policemen are Christians either. But the joy I've had of introducing prisoners, distressed families, old and young, to faith in Christ keeps me going. And I still love to do it. We've got a whole village yet who's yet to be converted, and we're still working on that one, of course. But I want to just finish by this reading, and then I'll sit down, I can assure you. This is a reading from Romans chapter 8. If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things? Who can bring any charge against any whom God has chosen? It's God who justifies, so who is it who condemns? Christ Jesus, who died, and more than that, was raised to life, is at the right hand of God and intercedes for us. Can anyone separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship, or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or the sword? It's written in the Psalms, for your sake we face death all day long. We are considered as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. I'm convinced that neither death or life, neither angels or demons, neither the present or the future, nor any powers, neither height or depth or anything in all creation can separate us from the love of God that's in Christ Jesus, our Lord. And that's my testimony tonight. I became a Christian in my teens before I joined the police force. And Steve became a Christian, as I've told you, at the age of 17. And I just finished with these few lines, which is written outside the training school in Greater Manchester Police. Stephen Oak's life was characterized by his deep Christian faith that he took every opportunity to share with his family and those with whom he came into contact. Therefore, it seems wholly appropriate that a fitting epitaph for Stephen should originate from the Holy Bible. The words of the Lord Jesus, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Thank you.